This is Scenic Roots, Talking Writing. Good afternoon. Our guests this afternoon are poet and songwriter Charlotte June and poet and fiction writer Kate Landers, who is also the vice president of the Chattanooga Writers Guild.
This is a song that's about sinkholes and romance, which are important things where I come from.
Thanks, Charlotte June. So I was going to read something that they quoted you online. I think maybe you wrote it, Charlotte, because it's written in the first person. It says, I'm Charlotte June, and for many, many years, I worked passionately as a musician, writer, and teacher in various capacities. Then during one stunning and surprising year, I became a parent, and my journey changed. And I wondered if, you know, since you are both parents, if that's true for both of you, did that have a big impact on your life too, Kate, when you had children?
I think it's one thing to have a child. That was a surprise, which my first was a surprise for me too.
It wasn't planned.
Nope.
But you knew basically how these things happen, right?
I mean, you know, I guess there was a chance, but I don't know. When you've never been pregnant before, you're like, that can't happen to me. Like, that's something that other people do, but it happened to me.
That's so true, isn't it? I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, it's always the, you know, other people who have their lives together and are planning for this. But nope.
In my case, it really was something that was not likely at all. And when I was in the hospital delivering, these young nurses kept coming in and looking at me. And I was like, finally, I was like, hey, why are you looking at me? Is it because I'm the oldest mom you've ever seen? And they were like, yeah.
I guess if you ask a question like that, and nurses tend to be kind of blunt anyway about that kind of thing, don't they?
Indeed. I was not in the least offended because, you know, no one was more surprised than we were, so.
Well, that's kind of interesting then to put your perspective with Kate's. I don't know how old you were when you became pregnant, Kate, but I'm assuming you were relatively young, right?
I became pregnant when I was 26. Yes, I was still pregnant. I don't know the math. 25, 26. No, we just weren't planning it.
I love the British expression, I fell pregnant. So, like, I love that expression. It's so, like, oh, I wonder how that, I was just walking along.
It's a very poetic way to put it, though, don't you think?
Indeed. Yeah.
So the question is kind of hanging in the air. Is it possible to plan a pregnancy? You know, it seems like...
Oh, I know people that have, and they're like...
And it doesn't happen, right?
I know people that it's all unpacked exactly the way they planned it.
Wow. Yeah.
When I plan my second child, and yeah, we just, you know, got down to business, and I fell pregnant very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't meet my husband until we were in our 40s. So, you know, in the beginning, we weren't trying to and we weren't trying not to. But after nothing happened for a really long time, I think we were operating under the assumption that...
This probably wouldn't.
Yes. It was a false assumption.
Apparently. And also a false assumption that apparently that it's problematic for a woman past 40 to have children, right? Don't they say that?
Oh, yeah. At 35, you go on the high risk.
Oh, yeah. I was with the advanced maternal age doctor, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I do think there are a lot of risks. I just think we were very lucky. And we count her as sort of our little fairy child who just, you know. I know when I met her, I was like, oh, you're the one. You're the one that I haven't met yet.
So. That's exactly what my wife said about her son.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, I've known you.
I knew you were missing. You were something was missing. Huh. Hey, you, I know you. Yeah.
And completely changed your life the minute she came in, huh?
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, musician. It was a really big change. I know people, I mean, I know musicians that just take their babies out on the road with them, but I'm just not that person. I'm not organized enough, mentally organized enough to do that. It would be a disaster for everyone involved.
I guess you have to make a decision about whether that's a good idea anyway, right? To have your children in that kind of situation. How do you feel about that, Kate? Did you? Because the impression I have, and I have to tell you, you win the prize for brevity in terms of what's available when one Googles you. Kate Landers grew up in the suburbs of Houston, but now lives in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She really likes clickety keyboards, iced coffee, and other people's dogs. That's it. That's
so
all I could find. And I'm thinking, but I know more about Kate than that. But I don't know where I found it because I couldn't find it again.
I think you found it on my website, which my husband set up after the last time I was on here. And you asked, where can we find more of your stuff? And I had to say nowhere. So my husband set that up, and that is the bio that I put on the page. And that is all.
That's pretty sneaky. Okay. Well, I don't blame you. My brother spent his life building computer networks and working with computers. If you Google that man, there is not a sentence about him on the web.
Because Which, he's you clever know, in these enough days, to erase you know. His footprint.
Yeah. It's a choice you have to make, you know, like how much of yourself you want to put out there for people and how much you have to keep to yourself. And, you know.
I am so glad that there was none of this when I was in my 20s. It would have been mortifying. My 20s were a very wild, improper time.
But this is supposed to be.
I think so, too.
That's when you're figuring it all out, isn't it?
I think so, too. And I'm so sad that now people have to feel like you make one drunken mistake and you could become a meme.
Yeah.
There was a headline on an article yesterday, the psychological and emotional impact of spending time on social media. And the more time you spend on social media, the more likely it is that you are emotionally and physically affected by it.
Right.
And probably not in a good way.
Yeah. We react to being actually in the physical presence of other humans. I mean, I think there's this sort of vibrational thing. It's the same thing we see with music. And I can see it, you know, I teach Music Together, which is a early childhood music program, and you can see it in littles. You know, they react to that, the presence of music in the room, voices in the room. It's a completely different experience than what you get from them when they just hear background music kind of going on. I mean, I think sort of need that vibrational. There's something powerful and human about it that makes us feel connected and like we belong. And I don't know that you can really get that via social media. I grew up about 7 hours east of New Orleans. So I went to New Orleans a lot in my early musical life.
That's an education.
There was a lot of New Orleans. And so I love New Orleans horn bands, and I've heard a lot of New Orleans horn bands. But I had never heard a New Orleans horn band in a tiny, tiny venue. And one New Year's Eve, we went and we saw Rebirth and Soul Rebels were playing at the Treme, which is like this little, I mean, it's basically where all of them cut their teeth, right? It's where all the young horn players play. So it was like the great big homecoming. You know, it was a massive party in this tiny, tiny room. And the feeling of those horns, that air, it was so powerful. Like, there wasn't a still foot. You can't not dance. It's like it's physically impossible to resist dancing in that environment, you know?
And I think, you know, New Orleans is an education in how organic music works, right? This is not showbiz music at all. This is music made by people that you have the feeling. Well, it's not a feeling.
It's food.
You just walk down a residential street, what appears to be a residential street anyway, and all of a sudden there's a club and there's all these musicians piling out of the place, you know, in what appears to be, you know, just a regular residential neighborhood. You know. So you are, at this point, a musician or not?
You mean, am I a professional musician?
No, when you were in New Orleans the first time.
So were you already playing
at that point?
Yes, oh yes.
I read another article talking about it's not just the notes that are played, but it's the feeling that's around those notes. And that's what you need to connect with. That's what brings you to inside the music, you know?
That's what it makes me think about musicians that everyone knows of as a musician's musician. You'll hear people say that, oh, he's a musician's musician, right? He may not have, the greater populace may not have even heard of this person, but you can start pulling musicians and say, oh, do you know this person? And everyone's like, oh, yeah, you know, and we all. And I think it's that awareness of craft, maybe, and
I think so.
Which makes me think of writing. So I'd love to hear some of your craft.
Thank you for that, Charlotte. That's a really cool way of making that transition.
I did. I was like, oh, craft. Writing is a craft too.
Let me tell you, Kate has been recognized and has won awards as a fiction writer, as a poet, and also. And I think in some ways this may be the most challenging. And she also has written for children.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if it helps to have written poetry to write for children.
It just depends on how, if I just want to be silly or if I am trying to say something. It depends on how much Dr. Seuss and Jill Silverstein I've been reading lately.
Has a huge influence.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that, you know, if you're writing for children, first of all, you have to scale it down. I'm not going to go with Dumb It Down, because that's the worst thing you can do. But you do have to scale down the language, don't you? And yet at the same time, you want to communicate the same ideas that you would communicate to adults, but in a way that they can, because presumably their experience isn't as broad, your frame of references becomes narrower, and their vocabulary is perhaps not as broad as an adult either. So you have to be aware of that too, right?
Yes, I have received much feedback about my vocabulary, because I just feel when you land on the right word for something, I just want to use it, and I'm just stubborn and I don't want to change. So I just, whatever, I'll just move on from that person. But honestly, when I write children's literature, I write for the parents of the children, because I have been reading children's books for over 10 years and I have read so many, yes, so many bad children's books that I'm like, this one is going to be a craft next week. We're just going to cut this up and make it into something, and I'm never reading this book again. So as much as I enjoy writing children's literature, I never write to the child, because I know that they're not going to buy the book. The parent is, and the parent is going to read it. So this is for all you.
That's the shrewd marketer in you. But at the same time, and I think what you wanted to avoid, because it drives me up the wall, is that voice. When we were children, there was a woman who'd come on the radio in the afternoon. She'd say, "Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin." And she talks like that the whole time, you know, in short staccato sentences with this, you know, honey dripping from her tongue voice. It's like, you know, give me a break. You know, children are not from another planet. They've got the same feelings and emotions as the rest of us.
They also have really, really well-developed BS detectors.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a real challenge, right?
I mean, they do. And they can spot hypocrisy. Like, it's like they know, like, if something looks a way on the surface, but it's vibrating as something different underneath the surface, they can't tell you, they can't put it into words, but watch
them. They know it.
They know.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish my kids were more gullible. Like, I've raised two very cynical children, and I can't get away with anything.
That's the sign of a good educator, though. If your student, I used to say that, they'd be like, "Your kids are so skeptical." And I'm like, "Yes!"
But sometimes you want them to just believe in whatever it is you're trying to get them to believe. You know, whether it's just like, "Yes, honey, there really is a toy troll," is what we have in my house. You know, the toy troll comes and he's gonna take all your stuff if you don't put it away. Yeah.
How old are your children?
10 and 4.
And the 4-year-old doesn't buy the toy troll thing?
I don't enforce it as well as I should. I don't invite the toy troll over as often as I should. So I think she is starting
She's sussed it that there's holes in this toy troll story, huh?
Yeah, but she's going to be listening to this, so...
You can edit that part out.
Stum, I hear. So are you going to read a children's story right now, or something you wrote for adults?
I just brought stuff for adults today. The first thing I'm going to read. So I'm a member of the Chattanooga Writers Guild, and we have a spring contest every year. And I wrote this for the contest. It did not win. And... but I still really believe in this story, so I'm going to read it.
Yes. Wen Schmin.
Yeah. You know, I'm not in it for the money, okay?
That's
it's
right.
For the love of the craft. So I'm just going to read just the beginning of it. And I call it Earth 10. By the time the universe ended again, the planet Earth had already been blown up by its own star for almost 500 million years. Those who worked in the Earth department, considered seasonal employees, were always terribly bored as they waited tables or worked retail jobs for the 500 million-ish years it took for the universe to restart. Needless to say, there was an electric tingle of excitement in the air as everyone gathered into the boardroom for the kickoff meeting. Earth had only been approved through the finance department 9 universes ago, and there were still quite a few kinks to work out. Everyone had spent the off-season brainstorming improvements and was more than ready to share their ideas. Thankfully, someone had remembered to bring pastries and plug in the coffee pot this time. At the last planning session, there had been no refreshments, and the employees had quickly become disgruntled. Coworkers huffed phrases like, "not my job description," while simultaneously accusing one another of not pulling their own weight. It almost came to blows until someone smartly suggested they blame everything on Janine. Everyone agreed, and after that, things settled down. Still, the meeting had started off on shaky ground, and Earth 9 had suffered. The planet had been condemned and the whole solar system quarantined. It was quite the embarrassing fiasco, and the Earth Department was determined to rebuild its reputation. Today, Janine was standing by the coffee pot, making sure everyone who entered the room knew there was fresh coffee and mini bagels available, even though she had had nothing to do with bringing them to the meeting. A few folks muttered, "thanks, Janine," as they tore open sugar packets or plucked a butter pat from the bowl. Janine smiled modestly, accepting their misplaced appreciation, while at the same time not lying, exactly. Finally, the lights began to flicker and the small talk died down, to the relief of all the introverts. Everyone turned their attention to the front of the room, where a figure in a sharp navy pinstripe suit now stood. He called himself BPHD, which stood for Ballpark Hot Dog, his favorite food. The ballpark hot dog had been invented in a happy accident during Earth 4 after an intern in the mammals department had mistakenly been included in an edible things department email. Ballpark hot dogs had been a staple in all versions of Earth since. "Good to see everyone," said BPHD. "I know you all have some terrific ideas for Earth 10, and I look forward to hearing them all. So who wants to go first? Sudafed?" Sudafed rose, tucking her long blonde hair behind one ear. When she spoke, her voice was high and clear, like an echo at the apex of Mount Everest. "I feel like there's always too many bugs," she said, and several people in the room nodded in agreement. "Even after we introduce reptiles and fish and birds, there are still way too many bugs. I mean, in Earth 9, we had multiple ice ages, several floods, and the humans got the whole place condemned, but there were still too many bugs." BPHD rubbed his chin thoughtfully. "But the way we've always set it up, bugs are a staple of every ecosystem on Earth. Without bugs, life wouldn't be possible."
"I don't care. They're icky."
BPHD sighed. "And how many bugs would be acceptable for Earth 10, do you think?"
"Like five?"
"Five species?"
"No, just five."
"Thank you, Sudafed. Next. I have some ideas." "Ugh. No, Janine, but thanks. But next!" A small furry creature with large yellow eyes stood up.
"I have a proposal," it squeaked, and half the room said, "aw." Then it hiccuped, and the other half of the room blessed its little heart.
BPHD smiled warmly. "Yes, Mr. Snugglekins?"
"Last time, too many people from other worlds showed up, and we ran out of food. It was kind of a bummer."
"Yes, I recall." Mr. Snugglekins wrinkled his nose cutely.
"So I was thinking this time we could avoid that problem if we just made everything edible."
BPHD frowned. "So you want to make food out of rocks and dirt?"
"No, no, no, silly head," said Mr. Snugglekins. "I'm saying let's do away with all that yucky inedible nature stuff, blech, and just make the whole world out of lollipops and cotton candy fluff and chocolate ice cream."
He spun around in circles as the room gave him a standing ovation. BPHD pretended to write this idea on his clipboard as he waited for the applause to die down. "That is definitely something to think about for Earth 10. Thank you, Mr. Snugglekins. But what if instead we just asked everyone to RSVP and then put a cap on how many people could be there at a time?" Mr. Snugglekins giggled and shook his head.
"That's so lame. Who would want to come to a party like that?"
"Well, we're not really planning a party. This is work," BPHD said. Mr. Snugglekin shrugged.
"I guess that's why you're the boss man, boss man."
He sat down and whispered something to the sacred cow beside him, and then they both looked at BPHD and giggled. BPHD straightened his sleeve cuffs and searched the room. "Who else has an idea?" "I do. Anyone besides Janine?" "Yes, Cadillac Jack?"
I don't really have any ideas, but I wanted to let everyone know that the Black Hole Committee said it'll be conducting a test flush in our galaxy this time, so if we don't want the Earth to get sucked in, we need to make sure it's securely fastened." This time, BPHD really did make a note. "Got it. Thanks, CJ. Anyone else?"
"I'm standing right here with my hand raised, as you can clearly see. When you learn how to plug in a coffee pot, then we'll talk. Who else has an idea?" An ethereal wisp floated out of its chair and began to radiate love.
The people sitting around it gently placed their coffee mugs in their laps, looked up at the wisp, and sighed blissfully. "I have a suggestion," the wisp whispered.
Kate Lander's our guest, and I think if that story illustrates anything, the line between children's fiction, so-called, and adult fiction's pretty fine. I can imagine kids really enjoy that. Well, I'm thinking that I should ask you the same question, Charlotte, because you work with children all the time. So has that changed the way you write because you're working with children?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Yes, it's changed the way I write if I'm writing for kids.
This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. My guests are Kate Landers, whose website is katelanders.com, and Charlotte June, whose website is charlottejune.com. To close, a song from a session Charlotte June recorded in the Chattanooga Downtown Library a couple of weeks after we recorded this conversation in August last year.
The live experience.
Deep into that one.
Charlotte June, with her friend Jade playing bass and adding a harmony, recorded in the Chattanooga Downtown Library in the fall of last year. This is Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio, WUTC. I'm Richard Winham. Thanks for listening.